Krishna Samstapa Kacharya Sula Prabhupada Ki Ananta Koti Vaishnavinda Ki Nama Acharya Sula Hardasakur Ki Ramza Gosha Krishna Chaitanya Prabhupada Nanda Sri Raita Garan Harsha Vasili Gaur Bhakti Vinda Ki Sri Sri Radha Gaminda Gopa Gopina Shyamakunda Radha Kundi Giri Gavaran Ki Vrindavan Dham Ki Sri Maha Purnamadip Dham Ki Jagannath Puri Dham Ki New Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Yamunamaya Ki Gangamaya Ki Bhakti Devi Ki Samvira Bhakti Vinda Ki Tulasi Maharani Ki Sri Sri Garni Taya Ki Sri Jagannath Baladeva Subhana Devi Ki Sri Sri Radha Gopkula Nanda Ki Hari Nam Sankirtan Ki Sankirtan Yagya Ki Nityayako Premanandi All glories to the sum of the Buddhas. All glories to the sum of the Buddhas. All glories to the sum of the Buddhas. All glories to Sri Guru and Gaurangi. You girls are sitting too far away. Please come sit close. You take sit on a asana, please. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Dhaneshwar Das. Initiated by Prabhupada in 1974 in Gainesville, Florida. For the last 5 years, I'm preaching in Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, Moldova, Russia, like that. The focus of my preaching is what I call spiritual economics, and over the next several evenings, I want to give you an introduction to what I call spiritual economics. I just printed the first volume of my book, Spiritual Economics, so we're going to make those available. And we'll also speak about how to apply this philosophy of spiritual economics. Simply put, spiritual economics means how do we live the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita. Economics, this word, comes from the Greek word economos, which means household. Basically means how do you get what you need to survive. Food, shelter, clothing. Of course, in the modern day, this word is taken on a whole different meaning. And so when you say spiritual economics, many people think that this is what they call an oxymoron. Two words that don't go together. They're opposite in meaning. Spiritual and material we think of as opposite ends of the spectrum. So how is it possible to have a spiritual economics? Spiritual economics means how do we fulfill our requirements of living in this material world in a way that's consistent and supportive of our spiritual life. Okay, so it's not such a difficult subject. This idea first came... Prasadam. Jai.
Gornitai.
Nitai
Goranka.
Thank you. 22 years ago, I was living in Sausalito. And at that time, I was working as a stockbroker in San Francisco. And one day, I was reading Bhagavad Gita, and I was surprised to see, oh, look, Krishna is speaking about economics. And the more I read, the more I saw everywhere throughout Bhagavad Gita, throughout Srimad Bhagavatam, Isopanishad, the subject of economics comes up again and again and again. Now, when I say that, sometimes devotees get confused because you won't find the word economics once in this Bhagavad Gita. So how does Krishna speak about economics? He talks about it in different words. He talks about fruit of activity, right? So the fruits of action. Everybody works. They work for some purpose. And that's called fruits, the fruits of labor. So that's actually an economic idea. In modern day, we call that wages or profit. Right? Same idea, different word. Krishna speaks about duty, what you have to do. It's the same thing as activity or labor. Krishna speaks about ownership, proprietorship. These are also terms that are used in economics. So if we look at that language, we see that it comes up again and again and again. And as we go through the next couple of days, I'll point out some of these verses, and we'll see how Krishna actually defines an entire economic system right here in Bhagavad Gita, a spiritual economics. So tonight, what I want to start with basically an introduction to this idea. Which of you, or any of you, not familiar very much with Bhagavad Gita? How many are not familiar with Bhagavad Gita? Okay. All right.
So,
good. That's why you're all here. Thank you. So, I'll ask some questions. You may not be able to answer them, but maybe you will. We'll see. To begin with, we want to look at Krishna's final instruction in Bhagavad Gita. Who knows what that is?
Sarvanamam parichaja mamikam sharanam vaja aham kam sarvapatibhyo mokshesyamimashrujaha.
Very good. Translation?
Abandon all varieties of religion and simply surrender unto me. I will deliver you from all simple reactions. Do not worry.
Yeah. So, now, this is the final instruction in Bhagavad Gita. So what we call the bottom line, right? This instruction is like, what we're supposed to do. Now, this is a very strange idea that Krishna presents here, isn't it? Krishna is God, and we usually think that God, he wants us to follow religion, right? But here he's telling us to abandon all varieties of religion. All of it. Whatever you think of as religion, you have to give that up. So this seems a little strange. We have to understand this very clearly. What is Krishna speaking about when he says all varieties of religion? This word Prabhupada translates as religion is dharma. All these dharmas. Sarva dharma. Sarva means all. Dharma means religion. So all these dharmas, these things that we think we are supposed to do, give those up and do what? Mamekam sharanam vraja. Do what I say here in Bhagavad Gita. So what Krishna is giving us in Bhagavad Gita supersedes all other ideas of religion and some of the dharmas that we don't normally think of as religion. In order to get a proper understanding of this final instruction, we have to go back to the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. In the beginning chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, he's asking Krishna, take my chariot between the two armies. Is there a diorama of that? No. Take my chariot between the two armies. I want to see who's arrayed on this battlefield. Who do I have to fight with? Krishna takes his chariot there, and on the other side he sees his grandfather, his cousin brothers, so many relatives, and he becomes overwhelmed with grief. He says, Govinda, I don't want to fight. He said, how can any benefit come from this fight? He says, if all these men are killed, then the women will be unprotected. Right? Their wives, they won't have a man there to protect their wives. If the women are unprotected, then the family traditions will be lost. Huh? Now, family tradition, this means that the younger generations, that they perform yajna or sacrifice for the departed ancestors. When the living generations, they offer sacrifice for the departed grandfathers, great-grandfathers, and so on. And as long as they do that, the forefathers, they can stay in the heavenly planets. But if that sacrifice stops, if the family tradition stops, then those forefathers, where do they go? A very interesting thing, you know? Actually, they become the Yamadutas. Huh? The Yamadutas, they must know principles of religion, right? And so those who are followers of Vedic culture, before they come back and take a human birth again, they take birth as Yamadutas. You know what is Yamaduta? Anybody not know what is Yamaduta? No, okay. When sinful people die, there's, agents who come to take them to hell. All right. Did you see this movie? What is that? Ghost. This movie Ghost came out 10 years ago or more. Okay. You remember when that bad guy died? Those little things came and they took him away? Okay. So this is kind of like Yamadutas. Okay. Only they're very, anyway, they take the sinful people to hell.
Okay.
Right? But they must know the principles of religion. Otherwise, how do they know who goes to hell and who goes to heaven?
All right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so if the forefathers aren't if the women are not protected, the family traditions will be lost. The yagya, and that yagya, of course, had to be performed by the males. The women couldn't do those yagyas. So the men had to do the yagyas. So the men had to be present there. If the men are killed on the battlefield, then the family traditions are going to be lost. The women are going to be unprotected. And then the whole culture will be destroyed. So Arjuna was very concerned about that. Now, as important in Arjuna, he gave very good arguments, because all those arguments that Arjuna gave, they actually happened. They actually happened. He was actually correct in objecting on that basis. Now, where we want to ask, where did those objections that Arjuna was raising, where did they come from?
Scripture.
Yeah, can you be a little more specific?
Vedas.
Yeah. They came from, this is Vedic knowledge, this is Vedic culture. At that time, the whole world was functioning more or less under Vedic culture. So Arjuna was giving objections to Krishna from Vedic culture. Now here's our position. We now have Malacha culture, atheistic, materialistic culture. We're trying to establish Vedic culture. But Krishna, at that time, was telling Arjuna, reject those ideas from Vedic culture.
Vedic culture?
Yeah.
Wine.
Huh?
Vedic culture is the art of making wine, right?
Already.
Difficult.
Huh? I'm
Vedic.
Not sure, I can't.
Vedic. I thought you said Vedic.
Oh, no. Okay. I'm sorry. Vedic. Do you know this word at all?
Yeah, I know that.
Okay. So Vedic culture means from the Vedas.
Huh? Vedas. Did he say
rejected? Yeah. Krishna told him, never mind. I want you to fight this battle anyway. So Arjuna was making arguments from Vedic culture. Krishna told him to reject it. Now, we're trying to establish Vedic culture. So what does this mean for us? We want to know the final instruction, Sarvadharmam Prityaga. And Krishna's instructions here, as he told Arjuna in the beginning, to abandon this Vedic culture. That's the dharma of Arjuna's time. So when Krishna says sarva dharma parityaga, what does this mean to us? What dharma is Krishna referring to here for us? Any suggestion? Let's get an idea of dharma. Dharma, another way of translating this word is culture. Okay? Now, some of you from Indian background, maybe you've lived in India or in another place, and you have some idea what is a different culture. Culture is such a thing that it's practically invisible to us, because we're conditioned by it. We're trained in it from the time we're just an infant. So we don't really notice culture, it's just the way the world works. But if you go to another country, you go to somewhere else where they have a different culture, then you can immediately see some differences in the way people operate, the way they relate to each other, the customs, the things that they do. And then you have some idea of your own culture. So what are some of the things in our culture? What are some of the dharmas of American culture?
Meat eating.
Yeah, well, practically speaking, yeah. Everybody does it.
Baseball.
Yeah, that's a good one. What else?
Intoxication.
all the sinful activities.
What about the work ethic.
Yeah, that's good. This is... Now, the gross things, they're a little easier to see, but then you get more subtle and you say, like, work ethic. Right? Or sometimes you say, pay your taxes, right? You have to be a good citizen, pay your taxes. When asked the question in Russia, they say, well, you have to drink vodka, right? You have to have a dog in your yard, things like that. Every household over there, they have a big fence around their house. They don't have suburbs like we have here. They have the fence comes out to the street, and then everybody keeps a dog behind to protect whatever they have. What are some of the dharmas of India that we don't see in America? Where are you from India?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Where?
Punjab.
Yeah. So what do they do in Punjab that we don't do here? Grandmother will know.
Yeah.
Just like they're doing sinful activity over here, over there, they're going to the temple.
Temple
right? Every day. Sure.
Every morning.
Oh, they play cricket there. Yeah. Right? They have tea. Very. Now, I'll tell you the example I usually use when I'm in Eastern Europe. When I was a devotee for about 7 or 8 years, I lived in the temple, and then my wife and I, we finally moved out of the temple. We got our own household. We rented a house, and, you know, here, you're supposed to keep a nice grass in front of your house, right? So we were in Florida, and the house that we rented, there wasn't much grass. There was more dirt than grass. So I was thinking, well, I should be a good, responsible citizen. I should make my yard nice. So I was going to go to the store to buy grass seed. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. Where does grass seed come from? It comes from grass. Well, the grass will make its own seed, right? I just let it grow. It'll produce some seed. And then very naturally, it'll fill up. And all these, I'll just keep watering it so that the grass seed comes, right? This is the idea. Well, of course, this is the voice of inexperience, right? I had no idea how long this process would take. After 2-3 weeks, my so-called grass was about this high, right? And all the neighbors, their grass was nice and mowed normally. And so it started to look like nobody lived in my house, one of those derelict houses. So finally I knew I had to do something, because my next door neighbor, he sent his 12-year-old son over. He said, my dad wants to know when you're going to cut your grass. Right? So this is a dharma of America. You have to keep your grass cut. Not too long ago, I read on the internet, there was one 70-year-old woman here in America. She had no money. She's too invalid to cut her grass. And it became unsightly. And so the police, they actually came. They wanted to arrest her because she didn't keep her grass cut. And there was another man in Florida, 80-year-old man. His sprinkling system broke, and so he couldn't water his grass, so it all turned brown. So they came to arrest him for his grass being brown.
Where is that?
Somewhere in Florida.
Oh. Yeah.
So this is an idea of dharma, of traditional dharma of modern society. So when Krishna says, sarva dharma parityaga, this is what he means. We have ideas that we think we're supposed to do as Americans, as Indians, as whatever, you know, Mexicans, whatever. Our culture tells us we're supposed to do certain things. But Krishna says, sarva dharma parityaga, all these dharmas, you give them up and you do what I say here in Bhagavad Gita. Okay? Now we're going to look at some of those dharmas. We're going to go through and we're going to examine some of those dharmas. So we talked about the last instruction in Bhagavad Gita. Next thing we want to know, what is the first instruction in Bhagavad Gita? Who knows?
Asajana satyasvam or dinasvimitatma.
Yeah. Yeah. Not Tevaham Jatunasam, not Pamanimi Jinanipaha.
Not Tevaham Bhavishyama.
Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of you cease to be. So Krishna's explaining to Arjuna, you're not the body. This is the first lesson of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, he speaks from I think it's text number 11 or 12, and he speaks about 20 verses, how we're not the body. What's the nature of the soul, how the soul cannot be changed, cannot be affected by anything material. And then, after giving that instruction that we're not the body, then Krishna changes the subject, and he gives the second lesson of Bhagavad Gita. Well, what's that?
How one can become free from the bondage of activities by acting in transcendental consciousness called Bhuti Yoga.
Yeah, you're the first person that has been able to answer that question.
Right.
Smart point. Text 239. So we can go, we can read that. 239. Eshe te bihita sankye bhudir yoga timam shinu bhujya yukto yaya partha karma bandham prahasyasi. Thus far I've explained to you the knowledge, thus far I've explained this knowledge to you through analytical study. Now listen as I explain it in terms of working without fruit of results. O son of Prita, when you act in such knowledge, you can be free yourself from the bondage of works. So this then begins the second instruction. But Krishna, before he actually starts speaking about it, he gives some introduction to this subject. And that goes on for 8 verses. Then Krishna finally takes up the second lesson in Bhagavad Gita, text 247. Karmanya varikaraste ma paleshu kadachana ma karma palahitur bur mate sangosto karmani. You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you are not entitled to the results of action. Now, who of you have a job? Who has a job? Okay, why do you go to work?
I go to work because I see a purpose in my work.
That's not why you go to work.
That is.
That's your motivation. Why do you go to that place? Yeah, exactly. They pay you. Why do you go to work?
Because
they pay you. If they didn't pay you, you wouldn't go there, right? You'd go to someplace else. So this payment that we get, this is called fruits of action. We do our work, we do our activity, and the fruit is the paycheck. Now Krishna says here, you have a right to perform your duty, but the result doesn't belong to you. Now, immediately we see we have a conflict here, right? This is one of the dharmas of modern society that Krishna is saying, Sarvadharmam Pratyaga. Now, why would Krishna say that you're not entitled to the fruits of action? He answers that 2 verses later, text 249. Durena hyavaram karma buddhyoga dhananjaya buddhau sharam anvitsa kripana palahetava. He says, kripana palahetava. This word kripana means miser. And miser, we usually think of miser as a person who, they don't know the value of something. We usually think of miser as a person who has a lot of money, but they won't spend it. Mm-hmm. Right? Money is meant to be spent. If it just sits there, it's not serving its purpose. So, kripana, this refers to somebody who doesn't know the proper value of something. So we should know.
Come on in.
Hare Krishna. Come in, sit down, please. We should know the value of human life. Right? Human life, this body is like a vehicle. Right? This body, just like your car. You get in your car, for what purpose? You want to go somewhere. Right? You don't just go sit in your car.
Deliver the message of God.
Right. So this body is like a vehicle. And where is this vehicle supposed to take us? Back to Godhead. to Goloka Vrindavan. We want to use this body to go to the spiritual world. Huh? This body, by if we use this body properly, at the end of this life, we can be delivered to the spiritual world. Now, Gripana Palahetava, one who wants to keep the fruits of their work, they're misers because they don't know the value of this human body. They're using the body to get some paycheck instead of using it for going back to Godhead. You see? Krishna explains how to do work a little later in chapter 3. Chapter 3, text number 9. Okay, you can turn there.
Chapter 3.
Text number 9. Page 171 in my book. Yajnartat karmanon yatra lokoyam karma bandana. Tadartam karma kanteya mukta sangas machara. Work must be done as a sacrifice for Vishnu, otherwise work binds one to this material world. Huh? Right? So if we work for the fruits of action, it keeps us here. It keeps us bound. We have to come back and take another material body again and again and again. So this body is meant to be used as a vehicle to go back to Godhead, and we do that by using this body to engage in devotional service to the Lord. That devotional service is opposite. It's completely contradictory to the purpose of modern life. Purpose of modern life, we get more money, we work hard, we get a lot of money, we get ahead, we enjoy. Right? In this way we become happy. Maybe. But Krishna says, no. You use the body to do devotional service, and that way you become free from this material world once and for all. So this is a matter of economics, is it not? How to work. What kind of consciousness to do your work in? What to do with the results of work? This is spiritual economics. Now, let's go back to 247 and look at that again. You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Now, if we say, okay, you work, but you don't get the paycheck. Then the next question is, how am I going to live? Right? Because to function in this world, you need money. So, how are we going to live? Very important point here. Very essential point to understand is that we have to adjust our understanding to Bhagavad Gita. We cannot adjust Bhagavad Gita to our understanding. Okay? I'll give you an example from the previous verses. If we read 2:12, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Now, we could say, oh, wait a minute. My birthday is January 15th, 1983. Before that, I didn't exist, right? And my grandfather, he died 3 years ago. So what does it mean that never in the future shall any of us cease to be? This Bhagavad Gita is crazy, right? If we try to adjust Bhagavad Gita to our understanding, it doesn't work. It won't make sense. We have to adjust our understanding to Bhagavad Gita. So when Krishna says, never was there a time when I did not exist, but we know that this body has a beginning, then this tells us we're something different from the body. And we have to adjust our understanding of who I am in accordance with what Krishna is saying here in Bhagavad Gita. The same way here in text 247, that Krishna says you have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Then we have to see, how do we have to live that we can follow this instruction? We can't live according to the method of modern society because modern society is set up for fruitive work. We have to do our work differently. We have to have a different arrangement. Now, as we continue to read through Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives more and more instructions that are apparently that do contradict modern society. And if we gather those instructions all together, we get a set of instructions that actually defines an alternative economic system, what we would call spiritual economics. How late do we go?
8:00.
8:00. So we'll continue with this over the next several days, tomorrow evening, Monday evening, Tuesday evening. I'm here until next Thursday. So as long as we have time in the evening, we'll continue to discuss this in more detail. So we'll stop for tonight. We'll leave it at that. And if you have any questions, we can discuss.
How will we live? I don't think you've explained that part. You said that it's an important point to understand how we will live if we give up fruits of our activities.
Yeah, we don't have time to go into all that now. So that's coming up.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah. Did you understand?
I understand. Okay. Because I was an economics undergrad major and I'm an MBA program, so the MBA is helping me understand these different levels and stages of businesses and how when you're at the stock level, you know, it's really high and you know, you miss out on a lot of important steps, you know, when you're in school they only teach you about this high glamorous level, but you don't learn about the lower levels, you know.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yes?
My understanding of economics is that it's an allocation of resources. Are you going to be discussing that in the
discussion? We'll cover that. That's, we will cover that. Basically, production and distribution of goods and services is one explanation of economics. I don't know if you were here earlier, I gave the original definition of economics comes from the Greek word economos, which means household. And how do we fulfill our household needs? Which is actually, it can be done very easily. We've made it very complicated in the modern world with, you know, global economy, when everything can be provided within 5 kilometers of one's house. We send things all around the planet. Yeah. There's a reason for that. Anyway, so this book, this first volume of my book on spiritual economics, the subtitle is Understanding and Solving the Economic Problem. This book is an analysis of economic activity from the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita. We're not going to speak about that kind of thing.
Okay.
That is, what we're going to do is look at the modes of material nature. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to look at the gunas. There's 3 gunas, goodness, passion, and ignorance. And we'll see that according to the consciousness of people, they do their economics in different ways. Okay. So the chapters in this book are economics of goodness, economics of passion, economics of ignorance, economics of atheism. So I discuss economics from the perspective of consciousness. Now, economics is not a natural science. It's not like gravity or electromagnetism. You can't study it the same way you would study physics or chemistry. But that's what most economists do. They study it like, you know, we'll adjust the interest rate and the balance of trade and, you know, and debase the currency and all this stuff, as though that's all you have to do. Well, it's not correct. Economics is created by human beings, and if we actually want to know how economics functions, we have to understand how human beings function. If we're understanding how human beings function in this world, then we will be able to understand how to adjust the parameters to get the result that we want. Very simply, we want the result of goodness, but at the same time we're engaged in activities of ignorance. You can't have it that way. It's not possible. And I guarantee you, they're not going to fix this economic problem with what they're trying to do. Not going to happen. Guarantee it. Anyway, if there's no other questions, we can... Yes, sir.
During the part of your talk, when we were talking about Arjuna and Krishna on the battlefield,
right.
And Krishna was urging, it was Krishna's battle, essentially, and Arjuna would say, I don't want to go fight. And you said, he didn't want to fight because he didn't want to break the social contract that existed within the Vedic culture.
Yeah, that's good.
And Krishna was saying to him, don't worry about that contract, I am in the contract.
Okay.
Why did Krishna come from, I don't know if to say come from the Vedas, but aren't Krishna and the Vedas synonymous?
Yeah. Krishna gives the Vedas. In the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that Vedas come from him directly. So, yes, it is interesting that Krishna's, although Arjuna's arguments are from the Vedas, Krishna's saying, don't do that. Actually, what Krishna's giving us here in Bhagavad Gita is a different way of living, a different spiritual process than what they followed previously. Let me explain that briefly. Previously, the method of the Vedas was called Dharma Artha Kama Moksha. People would do their dharma, their duty. They would get some result, but they would live according to religious principles. Right? They would get some result, artha. With that, they would enjoy kama. And at the end of life, they would renounce that all, and then moksha. Okay?
What's moksha?
Moksha is liberation. They could go to the spiritual world. There was a very long process, because if you were born as a Shudra, first you had to become, through many lifetimes, a perfect Shudra. Then you could be born as a Vaishya. And after many lifetimes of trying to become a perfect Vaishya, you could then become a Kshatriya. Many lifetimes of that, you become perfect Kshatriya, then you can be born as a Brahmana. And the Brahmana, he could become liberated. But the Shudra, the Vaishya, they're not going immediately for liberation. You see? So it was a very long process, but it allowed people to fulfill their material desires while at the same time gradually making progress in spiritual understanding and spiritual life. But at the beginning of this Kali Yuga, Krishna, he's throwing all that away and he's giving us a new process here in Bhagavad Gita, a process of devotional service. And Lord Chaitanya came 500 years ago and he gave us the process, the powerful method, the Yuga Dharma, the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, so that in one lifetime, doesn't matter whether you're Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, or even us, we're Malechas, in one lifetime, we can go not just back to Godhead, not to Vaikuntha, we can go to Goloka Vrindavan, which is the very highest place, the highest thing. This is Lord Chaitanya's gift, to give us the highest understanding, the highest participation in love of God that exists. So basically in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is changing the whole system.
Okay. That's confusing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what's going on. Yes.
Is he changing the system just because we're going into Kali Age? What's the Grand Master
plan on this? I'm sorry, I couldn't
hear. Did he change the contract because you were going to Kali Age? Or
that's a little difficult for me to say why he did that.
Oh.
You have to ask Krishna that. But he, of course, Krishna knew at that time that he would come later as Lord Chaitanya. So I think that might have something to do with it, but it's just speculation on my part. I don't really know.
So, would you say that the economic problems we have today are caused by the fact that we don't have anything to base the currency on? We don't use gold anymore, we use paper?
The economic problems, and in fact, all the problems of modern society, come from the fact that we want to make illusion reality. Let me give you an example of that. Who has some money? Some paper currency? Anybody? You have paper currency? A few dollars?
Oh,
you can bring me some?
$2.
A $1 bill and a $5 bill or $10.
I have some.
Two different ones. Two different ones. Okay, that's good. All right. So what do we have here? We've got a $1 bill and a $5 bill. Or $1 bill and a $10 bill. This one is worth 10 times as much as this one, right? Why? Same amount of paper, right? It's not 10 times bigger. Why is this one worth 10 times more than this one?
Because we believe it to be.
There's money in the bank.
That's not correct.
It's because we believe it to be worth more.
Yeah, not believe, but you accept it.
Yes.
Huh? Because you all agree, basically, right? You agree that this one's worth 10 and this one's worth 1. But either one of them, what are they actually worth?
Nothing.
Nothing. It's paper. It's the same as this paper. Right? It's no different. But we try to make this illusion a reality. Oh, this one has value. Right? If you go to the store and you give them some piece of paper, you go to buy some milk and you just give them, here's some paper. You know, they say, what, are you crazy? I want the other paper, right? I need this paper, not this paper. Right? It's all, you're crazy. It's all paper. This one's worth, you know, this one has more paper here. No. We want to make illusion reality by, first illusion is there is no God. Second illusion is I'm the body. Third illusion is I can be happy through sense gratification. Fourth illusion is money has value. Fifth illusion is corporations are real. And they go on and on and on. There's so many illusions. We try to make these illusions reality, and that's what creates the problem. If we just live according to reality, all the problems would just go away. They go away. You don't need the UN and the IMF and the World Bank and all these people flying all over the planet to meet together. It's not required. We just have to live according to reality. And then these problems, they don't exist. So, this is the whole point of Bhagavad Gita, right? Or, of course, Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam states in the very second verse that reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all, that this is the highest truth. So we want to distinguish what is illusion, what is reality, and we want to live according to reality. So this is spiritual economics. Okay.
The Prabhupada said we needed land and cow.
Yes.
So you That's about gold.
Land and cow is reality. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, you're making this point about alternative different currencies, right? Paper, gold versus paper currency. There's a problem with that. Okay? We have economics of goodness, economics of passion, and economics of ignorance. This gold is a currency. If paper is a currency, would be which one? Which do you suppose?
Ignorance.
Ignorance, right. And gold is a currency, which would be which one? No.
No. Oh, that's the
ignorance also.
It's also
ignorance. In economics of goodness, there's cooperation. In economics of passion, there's competition or trade. You actually do trade, barter. In the economics of ignorance, there's exploitation. The Bhagavatam says that wherever there's gold, there's falsity, cheating, and irreligion. So even throughout the history of Western civilization, first thing we should understand is that the money as a medium of exchange did not begin until about 600 BC. Before that, people just engaged in barter. This is reality. I have potatoes, you have apples. That's reality. We can eat them. Let's exchange. Then the Greeks, actually, they came up with money. The first money that appeared in India was Greek coins, about 600 or 300, 400 BC, something like that. And then gradually this idea took hold, but money actually destroys Vedic culture. And I'll speak more in detail about that later. But the simple fact is that whenever you use money as a medium of exchange, it doesn't matter whether it's gold or anything else, it destroys culture. There was gold, sure. Balaram, when he was gambling at the chess match, he was betting gold coins. But it was just a convenient way to keep gold. It wasn't used as what we call money today.
Gold has the same notion that paper money does because it's a metal, right?
Gold has value. Actually, Krishna...
What is the quality that makes gold gold?
Krishna gave it that quality. Krishna actually imbued gold with his quality. So it's such a substance that never tarnishes, and so on.
It is different from lead.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Krishna has given it some potency like that, but still it's not meant to be used as a medium of exchange. I mean, let's say we have to be very careful to understand how using anything as a medium of exchange actually destroys the culture that we want to create. We want to create the Krishna culture, a culture based on Bhagavad Gita. And to do that, we have to understand very carefully the economics of it. Otherwise, we cannot be successful. Anything else?
I wish you would speak to some of these leaders that have...
Our government leaders?
Yeah, these people that are in control of all
the money. You can buy my book and send it to them. Send them a copy of my book.
A whole box.
But I mean, there is some kind of exchange. You say that money destroys native culture, but there is some kind of exchange. You know, when Krishna goes to buy the fruit, he's bringing something.
He brought grain.
Trade.
Yeah, he bought grain. He saw his parents giving grain. Mm-hmm. So he took grain in his little hand.
And when he left, what was in his basket?
Jewels.
So there must be something.
That was an exchange of love.
Right. But it made her rich also.
She wasn't after that. She was just trying to please Krishna.
Right.
Which is what we should do.
Yeah. Right?
And then we will also become unlimitedly wealthy. Doesn't matter how you measure it. Mm-hmm. That wealth will be in your happiness and personal satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. But how does it destroy the culture? I don't understand how.
Come back tomorrow.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Let me say, I also have one here. There's some brochures from our Vanashram community in Ukraine. We call it Gita Grad. You heard Prabhupada speak about Gita Nagari, right? So Nagari, this Sanskrit word, means place, and Grad, or Gram, also in Sanskrit means place. So we took, in Russian, that Gram becomes Grad. So you have Leningrad, Stalingrad, so now we have Gita Grad. So we're making Vanashram community Gita Grad. I've got a few brochures here, you can pass them around. What we're trying to do is follow Prabhupada's instructions exactly as he was telling us to do. How to live simply, how to produce only what we need, use only what we produce, and so on. I have more of those if there's not enough to go around. I'll bring some more. Or you can get some for me before you leave. I'll go to my room. Okay. Thank you very much. We hope to see you tomorrow night. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.